What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded at TBRCon 2023. TBRCon is an all-virtual sci-fi, fantasy, and horror convention that I directed and organized and was founded by David Walters of FanFi Addict. And this year we had the pleasure of hosting 30 author panels, which were absolutely amazing, and I highly recommend checking them out. But since so many of you listen to podcasts and prefer that over watching things on YouTube, I have published this live author panel here on the SFF Addicts podcast feed. I'll be releasing a new author panel every Friday until they run out. So until then, sit back and enjoy this week's TBRCon 2023 author panel. Enjoy.
Hi, everyone. I'm Miles Cameron, and I'm going to be introducing today's panel, which is on bringing history into your speculative fiction. I just thought I'd toss in speculative fiction because there's not just history in fantasy. There can be history in science fiction, too. But mostly we're here to hear from other people. So I'm just going to ask everyone to start out by introducing themselves, and I'll point at Tasha first.
Hi, I'm Tasha Suri, and I'm the author of a number of fantasy books, and particularly The Jasmine Throne and its sequel, The Oleander Sword, which came out recently. And I also wrote a historical-inspired gothic called What Souls Are Made Of.
Freya.
Hi, I'm Freya Musk, and I am a writer so far of historical fantasy, The Last Binding Trilogy, of which the first two books are out, and I'm going to wave them at you. Marvelous Light is the first book, and A Restless Truth is the second. The third book, A Power Unbound, is coming out at the end of this year.
Thank you. Jelly?
Hi, I'm Fenderson Jelly Clark. You can hear my toddlers in the background. I'm the author of several fantasy books, including A Master of Djinn, which is the most recent. It's a type of steampunk historical fantasy, as well as Ring Shout, which was a novella, which itself is a type of American Southern gothic horror type fantasy.
Thank you. Tilda?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Tilda Cold-Hold. I am the author of the Hank God trilogy, which you can see behind me. First one being Northern Wrath, and that is historical fantasy about Vikings and Norse mythology.
Thank you very much. And Leslie, bring us home.
I'm Leslie Penelope, and I write fantasy and paranormal romance. My first series was Ursinger Chronicles, which was an alternate 1920s epic fantasy. And my latest novel is The Monsters We Defy, which takes place in 1925, and it's a fantasy heist.
Cool. Okay, I'm going to launch right into this because we have a ton of questions. And thank you all for providing questions. I really appreciated it. So here we go. First question, and I am going to start with Leslie. So while I read, you can think your way through what you want to say. How has history and historiography influenced your writing in speculative fiction?
I think that I've primarily written historical fantasy. I have some contemporary stories that are more paranormal, but I get a lot of inspiration from the past. You know, creating new worlds, basing it on existing cultures, or trying to combine cultures and interesting things that I've found in the past to create new worlds. Or if I'm setting it in our world, really basing it on like real things that I've researched. So I kind of discovered that I actually like to do research. And it's really helpful in sparking creativity for inventing new things. I think using history as the basis and the grounding so that we can all relate to it, even as I'm trying to push the envelope and trying to do something that you might not have seen before, at least in the way that I'm doing it, it's always grounded in something in the past and something real that I thought was fascinating.
Jelly.
Yeah, I think pretty much very similarly. I think, I don't know if I set out to use history to tell my stories, but it becomes a source of inspiration. Some little historical nuggets, some aspect of history helps trigger my imagination to write a story. And so for those stories that I have set, on this world, They tend to be inspired by some historical event, and even stories set on other secondary worlds are influenced in many ways by historical events that have happened. So, you know, I think it's a great source of information, great source of inspiration.
Thanks. Tasha.
I think I agree with what everybody has said. I think that history is a huge source of story and inspiration, and I've definitely found it very inspiring. But I also think that I feel like I'm following quite a tradition. A lot of writers before us have drawn from history in big ways. So much classic fantasy is heavily, heavily drawn from history. And even sci-fi as well. I was recently watching the OG Star Trek series and was going, oh, the Cold War again, and the Cold War, which I realized was contemporary at the time. But nonetheless, you can see the way that real events influence the way we write speculative fiction. And it's really quite fun to be part of that tradition and drawing from real things that happened.
Priya.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I wish I had known earlier when I was in high school how much of history is just story, and that, you know, so many stories are in history waiting to be stolen and forced into funny hats and disguises and put in a new place. So I think that is a lot of what we do, even when we are writing fantasy in secondary worlds. For myself, so far in my career, history has been really important because it has been the setting, because like a fool, I thought, great, I only have to do half the world building. I can steal the other half, not realizing how much world building decision making goes into the process, even when you are using an existing historical setting. But I think history and speculative fiction play really well together.
Tilda.
I agree with everything that's been said so far. I probably lean a lot more on history than fantasy at the moment, at least for the first trilogy. And I think I've learned a lot from that in what research can do and can bring to a story, so that I now feel more comfortable writing fantasy that's maybe a bit further away from history, where at the beginning it was quite nice to be able to ground myself in true research and just really dig into it.
Well, I'm glad we all agree. So I'm going to move on to the second question. Is there a specific historical event or story that brought you to your fiction, that made you want to write that story? Or frankly, that's just such a good story that you want to tell it right now? I'm going to start with Jelly.
There's been something in my eyes that said, pick me first. You know, I don't know that there's a specific event that made me want to write stories that pull from history overall, but I can say that there are specific events that made me want to write a certain story. And so, for instance, I have a short story called The Secret Lies of the Nine Negro Teeth of George Washington. And that story was inspired by the fact that the first president of the United States, George Washington, owned in his possession several teeth from enslaved people. And if anyone's from the United States, you know, the popular mythology is that George Washington had wooden teeth. And no, he had teeth made out of various things, and he had these in his possession. And so I went down the rabbit hole trying to find out more about that, only to learn that there is nothing more about it. It's literally just a notation in an archive. That's all we know. And so it inspired me to write a story called The Secret Lives, where I was able to draw on magic, fantasy, just really, you know, fantastic world building to tell this story. And so all to say, this is how I would say history inspires me. Some event, some tidbit of history sparks my imagination, and we see where things go from there.
Cool. Jelly, I can't stop my, I said I wouldn't interject, but I have to say, do you know that some of George Washington's slaves ran away and joined the British Army to be free?
One of my favorites. Yes, I taught that. Yes. Yes, they did. And he was quite upset about it.
Yep. Just one of my favorite stories. Tasha.
Somewhat related. That's one of my favorite short stories that I've ever read. So I'm not going to fangirl, but I just thought I would mention that. I feel that one of the events that's really inspired a lot of my work was the Mughal war for the throne between Aurangzeb and Dara Shikoh. And I was most interested in their sister, who was a mediator between them. So a lot of my earlier stories are really inspired by the various Mughal emperors and the way that they variously did a very bad job of keeping or passing on thrones. But to be quite honest, I always felt like I came to history not through a great love of history itself, but through a love of vibes and aesthetics, which is very shallow. But I think that people should be able to reach for history and learn about history through whatever avenue most appeals to them. And for me, it was things like Bollywood films. So I grew up watching the films that my dad loved, like Mughal-e-Azam, which is a real classic, and introduced me to that moment in history, but didn't really tell me anything about the history. So that was something that I had to explore a little later on my own.
Freya.
Excellent. I'm very glad Tasha has now given me permission to be shallow, because I have to talk about the decision-making process as to why I set my trilogy in Edwardian England. And when I first was thinking about this series, all I knew was that I wanted to write a series of queer romances that together formed a historical plot. And I was looking around for a setting. And I think we can probably place the blame on the movie Titanic, because I thought I have to set one of these on an ocean liner at the time of the Titanic. The aesthetic there, perfect vibes. And then when I started researching what was actually happening in the Edwardian era, which is a quite short little historical time period sandwiched between Victorian and World War I, what I was finding out about the politics of the time and what was actually happening in Britain at the time shaped the thematic arc of the story. I found out about what was actually happening in terms of class struggle and discussions about power. And so there's a scene in book three, which is actually set in Westminster with politicians talking about a real issue of the budget and social welfare. That was a huge deal at the time in 1909. And so because of that, I think the romance in book three, but especially the arc of the whole series, became about the responsibilities of those who possess power. So history started off quite as just a setting for a story I wanted to tell, but really began to inform it in a way that I think is completely unavoidable once you start digging into what's actually happening in any time and place.
Tilda.
So to continue the shallow trend a little bit, I didn't think that I would ever be able to write something that was based on history. I never took an interest in history as a teenager, but when I grew up as a Dane, but away from Denmark, outside. And so the stories that were always told at home were stories of Norse mythology. And so as I was growing up, trying to figure out what was my culture, where was I actually from, I went back to those stories that I remembered and found a lot of comfort in them and started finding the research about Vikings quite interesting. And through the research, I found a will to write about that. I found that there were so many wonderful stories, and I just wanted to have an excuse, basically, to go further into the research and the history. And that was writing the books.
So I'm going to take from what I just heard that what we all agree on is that stories that are good stories and aesthetics that we like give us the passion to do research. So I'm going to skip down to the research question. And I'm going to start this time with Tasha, and I'm going to ask, where does research end and the story begin, and how much do you like doing research? How do you do research? Talk about research.
I really love research. I realize that my saying that I came for the vibes may suggest that I don't, but I think that what is fascinating about research is how much you're never told about history and how much seems absolutely unreal and how many gaps there are. So I won't go on a huge tangent, but what I think the point when research stops is essentially when you find that you have found the gaps that you want to fill, for lack of a better way of putting it. So for my YA novel, I drew on the history of Lascars and Southeast Asian, South Asian and Middle Eastern sailors in Britain. And there just aren't records. Oddly, there just aren't records for a country that's so fond of keeping records. They didn't really keep records here of that. And that in itself was a whole story that I wanted to explore, but it was that gap that allowed me to make the leap to start storytelling, essentially.
Cool. Leslie?
For me, research kind of never ends, but that's because I love taking in stuff and I'm always finding something that I can use, even if it's very small. But for my last book, The Monsters We Defy, I actually found the story through research. All I knew at the beginning is that I wanted to tell a fantasy heist that took place in the Harlem Renaissance era. And I didn't have any characters. I didn't know what they were stealing. I didn't know anything until I started looking back and diving into the research. And I found a real life historical figure who then became a character in my novel, who I fictionalized. And then I was able to bring in other more well-known characters, like Langston Hughes is in the book and Carter G. Whitson is in the book. And yeah, I didn't think I liked research either. I never had like a background in history either. I actively avoided it as much as possible in my early writing, you know, writing Second World Fantasy, although I did end up doing a lot of research on, you know, just to various aspects of like technology and all the things you have to do when you're world building, you know, like how does economics work and how does trade work and how will I make my own version of that? So after like begrudgingly being drawn into research, I dove into it headfirst with this book, setting it in the real world. And yeah, I was fortunate to find just a newspaper article that had this person, this character who became my main character. And I spent weeks trying to find everything I could about her, and very little is known, you know, and then fictionalizing everything I didn't know and trying to make a story and build a world and then add powers and, you know, give her psychic abilities and flesh everything out. But everything goes back to research. And I research up until the very last word of the final draft, basically.
Tilda?
Yeah, same thing. The research never, ever goes away. It never ends. I feel like it continues even after the book is done. I feel like I always have more things to learn. And I research because I love it. I love the era. I love whatever I'm learning about. So I always want to keep on top of it. I'll go a bit further in terms of what kind of research I do, because I do a lot of in-person research, which I found has been really leading me down a path I didn't expect, meaning that for the Viking series, I joined the sailing crew of a Viking warship and ended up sailing with it for several weeks, for several years. And I expected to just go away just for one day, just see how it was, come back, know how to describe ships. And that is not what I learned. I came back and obviously I could describe the ships, but the important factor was really the people. It was only when I was out on the ship, on the water, that it really clicked for me what kind of person you have to be in order to live like this, in order to do this, in order to use the ship, in order to be together with so many people so closely for so long. And so that's something I've really taken with me from here on, and everything that I write now, I try to find that element that will get me to have that moment where the key kind of opens the lock and I kind of get what kind of person you have to be in order to find yourself in this kind of situation.
I'm definitely a fan, Tilda. Freya.
So I'm not a natural researcher, and I think my research approach is a little bit more do what you need as you go. And partly that is because I know myself, and if there is something my brain can do that is not actually writing, it will try and convince me that that is what we need to be doing. So I did a bit of general research into the time period as I was planning the books. So I am quite a planner, but then I just started drafting. And I would research a question as it came up, which is one of those things that you're also not supposed to do. You're supposed to just put a little marker in the text and move on. But I quite enjoyed that because it did mean that the research was shaping the story as I went. And I would stop and go, okay, how did women get into the British civil service in 1908? What kind of roles were they in and how were they chosen? And then I went and found that there wasn't a great deal of detail about that and just used what detail I could find and then moved on to the next thing. So a lot of the things that ended up in the book was just what I needed for the story, which is my way of world building when I'm world building in a secondary world as well. It stops me from going off on tangents and building a whole lot of stuff that I don't really need, which I then feel compelled to throw into the story for the sake of it. But I agree that there is no substitute for the occasional in-person experience. And when I was writing A Marvelous Light, one of the things that really was important to me was the aesthetic of it. And I was setting part of it in a house that was done up in the arts and crafts style. And when I was in England, I went to a place called Whittick Manor, which is a National Trust property, entirely done up in this particular internal style. And just the experience of walking through the rooms and thinking, how would I describe the visual effect that this is, which is like nothing else I've ever seen, was one of the best things I could do in order to create a sense of vivid detail for the first book.
Cool. Jelly.
Yeah, I like the discussions we're having on the different ways that research can be done, research in archives, research with 1,000 Google pages open, research and actually going out into the physical world and experiencing it. So I probably, when it comes to research, I bring in my probably professional background, academic historian here for all the people who. So my interest in history is a little less than shallow. And so I bring in basically what I learned, how to learn to do research academically for history. And so I find myself bringing a lot of that into when I do research. I even end up, I'm like, why am I in JSTOR looking at journal articles? And that's just where I naturally gravitate to. Or I'm looking for authors and I'm trying to see, are they scholars? Where did they get this from? Is this actually? And so I think I bring some of that into my research. When I Google something, I need to figure out who said this and where it came from before I'll accept it. And, you know, I agree with Leslie and Tasha that the researching never ends. I think it was author Tochi Onyebuchi once sent out a tweet saying, like, beloved, all those Google tabs you have open, close them eventually. I'm the person who I can never close them. There are like 100 of them. And I figure if I close them, I'll lose this little bit of information. So, you know, I research, I think in a bit of what everyone has said, I tend to research to a certain point that I start the story, because you'll never have everything you need before you start the story. That's impossible. And I'm always going to be researching something right up through the several drafts that have to be done. If it's a book, I'm still like, you get an arc, good luck, because I've researched and I've thrown in something new just before the last edition goes out. So it's a constant process. And to me, it's fun. Again, probably because of what I do. I think it's just part of what you have to do. If you're doing any type of writing, you're going to be stuck doing research. So get used to it.
Okay, we're going to move on to a new question. How important is accuracy, historical accuracy, in your writing? And I want to put some quotes around this because we are talking about speculative fiction. So we're not discussing necessarily hitting everything, but what part of accuracy, let me rephrase, what part of accuracy is important to you in your writing? What do you want to shape sort of just the way it was? Well, maybe you play with some other things and maybe discuss both sides of that equation. And this time I'm going to start with Tilda.
Yeah. So let's say where to start? I try to be very accurate in different ways. And I think the reason that I approach it this way, I'm going to give you an example. A lot of people, when they think Vikings, think of horned helmets. We know today that Vikings did not have horned helmets. And yet, still, whenever I say Vikings, people mimic the horned helmets. And I have to explain that this is not the case. And this is just something that's been continuing on for a very, very long time, where people have just repeated it in paintings and in films and so on and so forth. And even in speculative fiction, I feel a sort of responsibility not to carry those kind of things over. So to not start new trends that people are not going to do the research, and then it becomes known as, yes, everyone back then did so-and-so, they wore horned helmets, and when in fact that is not true. People just haven't bothered to go back to check the original sources for quite a while. So I try to at least avoid big pitfalls and to try to stay as historically accurate as I can. I also write very close to history in what I write, especially with the Vikings and with what I wrote afterwards. So to me, I treat all of it like historical research. I also treat the magical fantasy part of it, the mythology, as historical research. I try to focus as much on the myths as I can and not to diverge too far off. There's always room for interpretation, but I find a lot of room in interpretation in terms of why people did what they did. So in the reasons that people at the time acted in the way that they did, not necessarily changing the historical events, but maybe come with a different interpretation on why they happened and why people were motivated to do it.
Thanks. Jelly, may I ask you to go next?
Oh, thanks, Seth. So, I mean, I'm coming back to what you said inherently, that we're writing speculative fiction, and whether it's counterfactuals or what have you, is as much as you, even if you write in a historical world like counterfactual, where you write where something different's happened, as much as you're pulling on history, you're inherently, it's going to be inaccurate. It's, you know, you've changed the nature of history, period. So whatever you do, it's automatically entered the realm of something speculative. And so, I mean, for me, I think, much like Phyllis said, I think I try to give different ideas of accuracy, or perhaps truth, if we can use that term. I sometimes try to, I'll use the word vibes. Here I am using the word vibe, like I'm on Twitter. So I'll try to sprinkle aspects of history in there to give it a sense of accuracy. So if I'm writing The Black God's Drums and it's set in this alternate steampunk New Orleans that never was, nevertheless, I can draw on things from history that were, like a local group of free women of color who have a nunnery, for instance, and I can draw on those aspects. So I tend to find tidbits of actual history to put in there, even if I'm changing it. And so that's how I guess I can ground it and give the feeling that this has a semblance of accuracy, that it's something that is somehow rooted to our historical world, even if it's, again, completely speculative in some way. And then I suppose what I tend to try to do in my stories is, you know, even in history, getting away from notions of accuracy, because like Tasha said, there are always so many gaps and silences that can become problematic, and there are perspectives to come into play. I try to get at a larger truth that I'm trying to tell, right? So even if I'm talking about George Washington's teeth and I have werewolves and necromancers in there and what have you, I'm trying to tell a larger truth about enslavement, what it means for the first president of the United States, a country founded on liberty and democracy and all of these things, the paradox of slavery existing alongside that. So that's the larger truth I'm getting at. And it doesn't matter to me if I'm being quote unquote inaccurate, because I'm trying to get this larger truth across.
Hello? Sorry, I just seem to have lost sound. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Tasha, I'm going to ask you to go next.
I'm sorry, I'm the one who brought vibes to this conversation. I opened the door on vibes. I think that everything that Fenderson and Tilda said is really interesting, because I kind of want to draw a little bit on both of those points, about the Viking horns and also about how we play with history in speculative fiction. So I think Pratchett called it the Tiffany problem, right? That there is a vision of history that people hold very, very strongly. And if you negate it, even if you are being accurate, often that makes the reading, it throws them out of the reading experience and you have to drag them back in, which isn't quite what he said, but is kind of a summarization. There are humongously strong cultural and shared narratives of what history is that doesn't have much resemblance to real history. And that can be quite complicated, because I think a lot of fantasy, a lot of speculative fiction is about playing with those narratives. But then we also have some responsibility to play with the real history that took place. And then we have to ask, what's real? Because when I was writing about the 18th century, there were multiple sources saying slavery was illegal in Britain. There was no slavery. And then I found from the archives at Glasgow University, real records of adverts of white people looking for people that they had enslaved. So there was slavery. It was really happening. But all of these resources were saying that it wasn't real. And both of these things were considered factually true, because these were real records of the time. Both of them were. So I guess part of what is historically accurate is, who do you ask and whose records do you still have? Which makes things complicated again. So again, we're writing speculative fiction. I, for example, have mostly written in secondary fantasy worlds. But I think when you start trying to play with real historical truths and also with the cultural narratives about what people believe history is, you can end up in very interesting and often dangerous waters. But I think that that's part of what you do when you write. I didn't say anything about my own work really there, but I think those are some of the things that come up in the field that we work in.
Leslie.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. There's so much, you know, I'm writing in Black American history. My latest book and the next two books are kind of different periods in time. And so much of Black history is lost. We don't have primary records for a lot of people. They weren't writing diaries. They weren't being interviewed. So we have other people looking in and giving their opinion on what's happening, or and their opinion is biased in whatever ways it was. So looking between the lines and trying to represent, yeah, like an honest, like a heart truth, you know, a lot of it is just my beliefs about certain things. So in some ways I try to be extremely accurate with the things I can. You know, I created a map of DC in 1925 and I listed out all of the businesses. So I knew what my characters were walking by when they walked down the street, things like that, where there are records and I can be 100% accurate. I will be. And I feel like that can make up for the fact, you know, the parts where I can't be, where I don't know, and where I'm putting my, either the themes that I'm working on into the book or the way that I think it was, or I wish it was, or I hope it was. There's so much that we put in there. And also dealing with the magic, like what Tilda was saying, I'm dealing with hoodoo and sort of Black folk magic and all the different kind of diasporic traditions that were different in different places in all of the Americas and places where Africans went, and there's similarities and there's differences, and from state to state is very different, and anything that I can find, you know, is there's no cohesiveness to it. So at that point it's about what's the essence of it. Can I take what information that I've been able to find and boil it down to what I feel like the core is and be accurate and be true to that, to the spirit of what I think people believed in, what their values were, and what their hopes and dreams were. And that's kind of what I'm trying to put into the story in order to fill those gaps and also make a statement of what I believe in and what my book is trying to say.
Priya.
Yeah, I love that idea of using accuracy as your base canvas in order to move from there. And I think when I was writing my series, I definitely made the conscious choice to keep the base setting of it as accurate as I could, because I was writing about a hidden society of magic. And so the thing that they are hiding, that what's being hidden beneath, is the real history. And so, you know, for example, the Prime Minister of England at the time is still Asquith, but I did make a decision that anybody who appeared in a speaking role was going to be fictional. So I had to change, for example, who was the editor of a specific newspaper at the time, because I wanted the editor of the newspaper to have a small role in a scene. And what Fenderson said about the transformative nature of speculative fiction, I think, really helps us here, because I talk about the anachronism budget that you have when you're writing SFF. I think people come into speculative fiction with a slightly larger willingness to suspend a little bit of disbelief around the details, because they know that something else is being invented in this space. Look, it's probably inevitable that I will have stumbled into the area of somebody's PhD and got a detail wrong, and they are more than welcome to write to me and tell me about that. But I think because we are writing speculatively, we have a little bit more flexibility and wriggle room. And for me as well, I wanted to have something not just serve the story, but sometimes it serves authorial voice. So I had to go and look up when the word zap first came into usage. And it turns out it was probably, because it's an onomatopoeic, it was probably in the comic books of the 1920s. And I said, well, look, there's some magic being used here. And I really feel that the name for the sensation of this magic is going to be zap. And I'm fine with my character inventing that word to describe the feeling. But in another scene, I did use the word sexcapades and could not persuade my editor that my character in 1909 was going to come up with the word sexcapades all on their lonesome. And they said, no, find another word. So I think sometimes it's about what's serving story. Sometimes it's about what's serving voice. Look, I'm Australian. If a conversation doesn't contain the F word, did it really happen? And so I think there's probably a lot more swearing going on between my characters than there really would have been in intimate conversations at the time. But I've decided I'm folding that into my anachronism budget, and I'm fine with that.
So my next question is sort of a meta question. I love history, but we are in an interesting encounter moment in history, and I'm speaking to an academic historian, so I hope I'm not going to do this badly. But we're in a moment where we're discussing post-colonialism. We're in a moment where we're discussing systemic racism. We're in a moment where we confront a lot of bias in a lot of the writing of history. And so what I'm kind of curious about is, when you write, do you ever deliberately portray the bias of history? Do you ever play your own meta game where people, you know, we, as writers, we're used to the idea of the unreliable narrator. Do you ever play with the unreliable history, people misremembering, people mythologizing history? Is that something that would, that you do, or that would interest you? I'm going to start with Jelly.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that I'm trying to think of, I don't know if I consciously do it, but I can already think of several instances where I have done it, where people are purposely remembering the past in a different way, or the past is hidden in a certain way, or what people popularly believe is different. And I think in some ways, this goes back to things Tasha was saying, that people have these, I think you used the words, these humongous ideas of the past that may not be true. And so I think that's something, I don't know, I think it's probably something that I can even think of authors that I'm thinking of right now who play around with this to different degrees, certainly. But I can think of many who bring it up, because it seems to be a very human trait to have these different perspectives and memories of our past. Look, we're the only sentient species we know of on the planet who has history, who thinks about our past and tries to find ways to preserve it. And so therefore, not surprising that we also have different ways of remembering it. And I'm thinking of, and I've seen speculative writers do this, I'm thinking of Ken Liu's Dandelion Throne books. I think he uses the word, there's a word called re-remembering for when people create history. There's what people remember, and then there's re-remembering. And it's the understanding that, and he plays around with the fact that one group of people think, oh no, what I've recorded is absolutely so, and it never changes. And the other group are like, well, of course it changes, because we all are going to re-remember differently. And so I think that there's a way, I definitely think I've played with it. I've seen other authors play with it. I think it's probably so common because it's something that humans do. We tend to remember the past in our own different ways. And by the way, that brings tension into the story, which we're always looking for. Oh, I'm done. Yeah.
Miles, I think if you asked somebody else to go, we couldn't hear you.
You're muted.
I recognize that now. I'm old, and if I skip you, forget you, or forget to turn something off, please just yell at me and I will get it eventually. Leslie is what I said several times, hoping that you would go next, reading my mind.
Yeah, I'm sorry, my telepathy isn't up to par right now. But yeah, I definitely have played around with that as well. In my epic fantasy series, Earthsinger Chronicles, it's actually a big theme, at least in the first book, because there are hidden secrets. There are these two countries that have been at war, and neither one of them knows the true history of themselves and how they were actually connected. And there's like a big reveal at the end about who the nature of the goddess that they worship, like who this person is, and people are, it influences the rest of the series. So absolutely dealing with history, because yeah, like Fenderson said, it's so real that we know that history is told by the victors, and it's what we know now. We don't have any way of knowing how much of the information we think is true actually isn't, because it was just changed, and it was through the filter of the person who either wrote it down or whose accounts made it through. And there's so much that was destroyed and purposefully hidden, and also not purposefully hidden. I mean, people try to forget things for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they're just painful, and we want to pretend things were a different way. And there's sort of like the idea of a national consciousness or national values. You know, in America, we have very clear ideas about ourselves as Americans, that whether or not they relate to what actually happened in history, I'm very dubious, but that's how what it's created this culture that persists. So that's one of the really fun things to play around with, especially when creating new worlds and trying to write speculative fiction as a way of commenting on reality and doing it in a way that is not actual historical fiction, where people can get their backs up a little bit more about what you might be saying that contradicts with their idea about themselves or reality. But in a story, you can couch it and hide it and hopefully trick people into understanding what you're saying.
Tasha.
I think that I'm more interested in characters consciously playing with historical narratives and saying, well, thinking about how they'll be remembered, for example. So there's a lot of, not phrasing this very well, when you write a lot of stories with kings and queens and the like, they are very interested in being remembered in certain ways and will act in certain ways to ensure that they'll be remembered in those ways. And I find that stuff fascinating. And I also wrote one story which was all about the difficulty of finding history that has been erased and the price you have to pay for that. Often a very deep emotional and psychological price. So I guess I am interested in the unreliability of history, but I haven't investigated it in quite the way that Leslie and Fenderson have done so, which is fine. I think we all do different things. But yeah, that's my contribution, I think.
Freya.
Yes, I've been looking up a quote that I was thinking about while the others were speaking, and I found it now. This is a quote from Philip Gurevich, who wrote a book about the Rwandan genocide called "We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We'll Be Killed With Our Families." And the quote was, "To a very large extent, power consists in the ability to make others inhabit your story of their reality." And I think I've always been fascinated by stories in all sorts of media that are about this idea of suppression of story and historical story as violence. And I haven't written it myself yet, but I love exploring stories that do that. And I particularly like characters that are self-aware about the nature of their place in history and the fact that history is being written as people live it. And I think the historical TV show Black Sails does this really well. It's very meta. It's very self-aware. There's a lot of characters talking about how they are going to be remembered and how they can feel the forces of social pressure turning them into monsters. And they know that somebody else is going to write the story that they are featuring in. And the entire struggle of their existence is how can I be remembered for the fight that I am actually fighting and the person that I actually am. And I think that's an amazing theme for all kinds of fiction. It's not something that I think I've explored a lot in my own work yet, but I love seeing it, and I'm sure it's something I'd like to dig into in future.
Tilda.
I think it's definitely at the forefront of my mind already from the research stage that I can't trust everything. I can barely trust anything, to be honest. To always look a bit further. And to build on what Tasha said, I also have a character who's a side character, who is a real historical figure, a king. And he is remembered as being the first king of Denmark. Why is he remembered as being the first king of Denmark? He was the first person to brag about being king on a runestone, where everybody else who was a Viking at the time, you would live your Viking life, and then your buddies or your son or your father would raise a runestone in your honor. Harald Bluetooth did not do this. He raised his own runestone and said, "I am a king and I Christianized all of Denmark and I reunited everything." And so that is how he is remembered. And he is passed down as pretty much a hero for that in Danish history. But always, I remember being 8 years old, learning about him in history lesson and just going, this feeling horrible, like feeling the sense of betrayal. And when I went back through the history, I realized that was it. It was because he proclaimed himself king. No one chose him. Before, they were always chosen leaders. Now he just came in and said, "Hey, I'm the new king. And by the way, you no longer have religious freedom. Tough luck. I'm here now." And so I very much portray him that way in the story, which is not the commonly accepted way to portray him in Danish history. So I think I might have stepped on a few toes there.
That's a beautiful segue, Tilda. This isn't on my list of questions, but I'm just eager because it's something I have been thinking about a lot since the 2016 American election. Re-examining the so-called great leaders of the past in light of knowing that there are people capable of simply telling an endless stream of lies and getting a great many people to believe them. The figure that leaps to my mind is Louis XIV, who, the more I read his own words, the more I wonder if Louis XIV was Donald Trump, convincing the French nation to follow madly in his footsteps. But so I guess I'm now going to ask you guys, do current political events like the existence of post-truthiness, as I believe somebody referred to it, influence how you would look back at the so-called great figures of history? I feel like Tilde had already heard this question in advance and jumped right on Harold Bluetooth. I have some suspicions about Harold Bluetooth too, but I'm just wondering if anybody else looks down the barrel of this particular gun, and I'm going to ask Liz to start.
I don't think I have. I do think people have seen things in my books that I didn't necessarily put there. I had my one of my agents came to me about Song of Blood and Stone, the first book, and there's this despotic king, and he happens to have reddish hair, and she was like, oh, it's Trump. And I'm like, oh, I wrote that in 2013, so no, but I like where your energy here. She was very excited about this idea that I was writing about Trump when I wasn't. So sometimes you can get that effect just by basing it on other characters who shared maybe similar qualities. You know, these people are not in vacuums. It's like there's playbooks, it seems like, for tyranny. I don't think I've done it consciously, but it's always fun to see what people see in your work that might reflect current times. There's other things where there's a refugee crisis, and since I wrote it, I was writing about one. By the time the book came out, there was a whole different refugee crisis that people thought I was writing about. Those kinds of things, you know, happen because of publishing.
Priya?
I think it's hard to exist in today's climate without it influencing your writing in ways that you're probably not aware of. I like that idea about this idea of a playbook for tyranny. I think you can sort of file that also under like the banality of evil in many ways. I think these great figures are not as original as they think they are. They are not the first great man. They're not even a great man. They're playing into a pattern that's been set up and played over so many times that it's tired. Oppression is old. Evil is old. And I think no matter, even if you're deliberately using these people for inspiration, you're going to be hitting on patterns that existed before they did and before you even picked up your pen. So I think it's part of writing history. You're going to hit patterns accidentally because the patterns have always been there. Personally, I think I try to steal little bits and pieces from great figures or figures who have tried to present themselves as great, because there is something very relatable then about looking at a person who's very invested in their own narrative, and I'm going to present myself this way, and having your own characters or your more sympathetic characters be the ones who can see the ragged edges of whatever that person is trying to present themselves as. There's a lot of scope to create very dislikable villains by drawing on some of what we all know about the people who are trying to be the great figures of today and not really succeeding to the extent that they think they are.
Tilde, you can pass as you gave us Harold Bluetooth, or you can tell us more.
Well, I think we always kind of draw from the current circumstances. I don't think it's always intentional. Certainly for me, looking back when I've gone through later edits, I've seen things in the books that I didn't even know were there, that just kind of made it in. And when I look back at when I wrote it, I realized, oh, okay, this or that was going on, was happening either on in my personal life or in the world, and it just sort of made its own way in. So I think I see a lot of that happening on my end, but otherwise, yeah, I'm going to pass it along.
Jelly?
Yeah, I don't know if I have too much to add to this, because I think everyone has said I can relate to. So I think that I'm going to be influenced by what's happening around me. I think sometimes I'm not even aware that I'm influenced. I don't tend to purposely set out to talk about some incident that's happening when I'm writing. And also the way the publishing world works, for anyone who knows it, it's slow. And so sometimes people will ask me, like when I wrote Ring Shout, they were like, so this was definitely influenced by the George Floyd protest. And I was like, the book came out in October, like a few months after the George Floyd protests. You know how long it takes a book to go through a process? Absolutely not. But people see those things and people bring their own perceptions to your work. So that's normal. I like what Freya said about there are these patterns. And so people, our minds tend to organize patterns. And so people will see a certain pattern that you might be pulling from or might not be pulling from, but they'll see it. So yeah, that's my non-answer by saying I agree with everyone.
Yeah, to reinforce what Jelly just said, to me, the best book ever written about 9/11 was written by Ian Banks before 9/11 happened. It's called Look to Windward, and it's a science fiction novel. And I remember reading it after 9/11 and going like, wow, are you hitting the hard parts of this? Yes. Anyway, except, of course, that the culture behaves way better than the United States did. Pardon me, Tasha, your turn.
Oh, I have nothing to add, particularly. I think everyone has made really good points. I would maybe just say that I don't know that I believe that any of the great powers that we speak of, great men, let's say, just for a shorthand, were ever good. I don't know if you can have that level of power and influence and be a good person for very long, which I think is a fascinating question in of itself, but one that we've talked about in speculative fiction for generations. So I don't know that, just like evil is banal and always the same, I wonder if we're always looking backward and asking the same questions because evil never changes and there are always people who notice, essentially.
I am going to change the subject a little bit. So this was one of my favorite questions, and I can't remember which one of you sent it in, but I just loved it, and I hope you can bat it around to your heart's content. Is all of history fair game for writers, or are there areas of history that we should leave alone? And I'll spin that a different way if you like. Do you have a favorite culture and era, or do you love all of history? And you can go from one to another with ease. So that's a two-parter. And by the way, would it help you guys if I repeated the question when it was your turn? Or is everybody just so brilliant that they can remember through five other people? Okay, well,
I think
in that
we're good
case,
bouncing off each other. It's all good.
In that case, it is lovely to listen to you guys. In that case, I'm going to start with Freya this time.
Okay, so in terms of whether eras shouldn't be touched or whether all of history is free game. Look, my personal rules are don't punch down. Like, for example, you think of the very, very recent past, like everything is being fictionalized all the time. The TV show The Crown is on our television about people who are still alive and events that we remember. But it is basically impossible to punch down at the British monarchy, is my feeling. So, you know, people might have an idea about how you can fictionalize something and the recency will always affect that. And my second rule is, I think these things will differ from person to person. So don't assume you can tell stories that aren't yours, especially centering oppressions that aren't yours. So for me, there are certain parts of history in terms of time and place that I would not consider to be my stories to tell, and I would steer clear for that reason. In terms of whether there is something that I particularly like, there's a lot of talk there about find an era of history that hasn't been explored, find those gaps that Tasha was talking about. I actually find it quite fascinating, those eras of history that have been dwelled in so long by fiction that they have become their own secondary worlds. So as a reader of romance, the Regency is this entire, basically a shared fantasy world based on one or two people's original depictions of a very complicated time in British history that is even now just starting to be interrogated and pulled apart at the edges to say, why are we also invested in this particular depiction of this area of history? But at the same time, on a shallower level, there is a lot of comfort to be found in playing in a playground that has been so well built by the people who came before you. So I like Victorian, you know, gaslamp fantasy. I like Regency fantasy because there is a strong sense of world building beneath it, even though the history itself may not actually be particularly accurate.
Sorry, Leslie, I'm going to ask you.
Can I just add quickly that I researched the Georgian era, and having read so much Regency romance, I was shocked by how awful the Georgian era was. It was just monumentally horrible for everyone. Nobody was having a good time. And it was just like a handful of, rather inbred dukes at the top. It was nothing like the books I'd read. And I just think it's kind of fascinating to kind of look at the way the history and the world building of Regency romance are so at odds with each other.
And it was built to serve the story, like, because you're writing romance, there have to be 17 dukes. They all have to be single, young, good looking, you know, and potentially scarred in an interesting way, because that serves the genre that you're in.
Oh, yeah. And I love those dukes. Don't get me wrong. It's just they're so not like the real ones. It's terribly disappointing.
Well, think about like medieval fantasy. I mean, the medieval era is horrible. And I feel like that movie that came out, The Duel, that nobody really saw, it was supposed to be a great movie, but everyone just looked so terrible and like awful and the haircuts were so bad. Like I just couldn't stand to watch it. That's probably how it really was. But we have these, you know, idealized versions of medieval fantasy and they skip over all of the plague and the teeth rotting and things in large part, I think. I love a good Victorian or Regency era fantasy. I mean, romance as well, but there are only 20 dukes and they're probably all over 70. So, you know.
Leslie, some other time I'll try and convince you that the Middle Ages wasn't nearly as bad as the so-called Renaissance. But in the meantime, it is your turn.
As far as eras not to touch, I personally don't think there's anything I would stay away from. I mean, there's things I'm less interested in, but if I had a great idea for something, I would want to dive in and figure out how I could make it my own, how I could tell that story, how I could, I don't want to be afraid of a specific era or a specific place. But I think I do have an interest in sort of 20th century. Like I also have an idea in the back of my mind for like Iron Age fantasy, which I think would be very cool. I haven't seen enough of, but that would be so much research. And well, I like it. I'm just like, ooh, that's a whole different kind of thing. And it sounds a lot harder, but maybe if the idea comes to me. So I'm in the 20s and 30s. I'm doing something in the 1800s also. And yeah, which is harder than the 20s and 30s. But that's my answer. I don't want to be afraid of anything. We'll see where the muse takes me.
Jelly.
I'm laughing still about Leslie's depiction of the medieval era, people with rotten teeth and so forth. And I think there's a truth there. I think what Miles is pointing, like there's a book called The Bright Ages by this historian who wants to say like, let's move away from our discussion of the Dark Ages. It was actually a bit more complicated. Yet on the other hand, I think what Leslie's saying is correct about how, and as it goes back to what Tasha and Freya were saying about these ideas of the past having in fantasy having created their own in fantasy's medieval era. I mean, until it was grimdark, everything is like pristine and perfect. And, you know, and it's just, everyone's just living these wonderful lives so much so that people romanticize what it was, would be like. And they always imagine themselves as, you know, knights and so forth and not a serf, you know, making certain that my lord's turnips are harvested in time. And so, yeah, I think it's always funny about who, when we imagine the past, who we imagine would be. Like, everybody imagines in Regency era that they're going to be one of the dukes, and it's like, oh, no, I'm a slave on a plantation in Jamaica, right? Like, that's also happening during the same period. And so we have our, that's a whole other side thing about how when we imagine these stories, who we tend to put ourselves in and how we tend to cast ourselves in all of these things. But as far as my own take on the past, you know, there are certain eras I think that I'm more interested in others. That just has to do with the bias of what forms of history I find interesting. And that's for any writer. It's why we choose to write about this thing and not that thing at a certain time. I think there are, I won't say there are places in history that I would say that, oh no, that's off limits, but there are certain aspects of history, especially when we're dealing with atrocities or genocide or certain things where if I went to those areas, I would be very careful about wading into it and deciding what I wanted to say about that era and whether I needed to be in that era, right? So I think I would definitely give it thought. And I think that's just, I think that's normal. I think unless people are so arrogant that they just, you know, go wandering in a bull, wandering forth like a bull in a china shop, that you give it that thought. And so, yeah, that's how I'd answer that one.
Miles, we can't hear you.
Sorry, I know I did it again. Thank you, Tasha. Jelly, I'm just going to go back to you and say, do you have a favorite period? Do you have something you really like?
Oh, as much as I seem to be doing well writing all of these like you know, late 19th century Edwardian into early 20th century novels. I am a complete fantasy secondary world, medieval Randland, Dragon Reborn type person. So if I'm going to write, it's going to be like pre-industrial. So that's actually probably my favorite to read. That's why I love fantasy set in those eras. But I, for some reason, who knows, you end up writing where you write, right? So that's what happens.
I just want to jump on something that you said, Jelly, and say one of my favorite professors in university in the 80s, who was a Marxist, loved The Lord of the Rings, but asked us one day how many peasants he thought it took to support the rangers like Aragorn, who were living in the woods. And his deconstruction was fairly horrifying. And I've never seen The Lord of the Rings the same way since. Anyway, Tasha, it is your turn. I realize you spoke, but I don't think that you were taking your turn.
Oh, no, I was just jumping on. I had to talk about the Regency with Freya. It was very important. In terms of what history shouldn't touch, I think that arguably we should be able to write anything we want. But then I think there is a sort of a ghost weight that you need to kind of put in place. Go, is this extremely haunted history? And are they my ghosts or not? So if you look at essentially genocide, great tragedies in history, that feels very ghost heavy. Maybe this only works in my head, but I'm going to persevere. And if they're not your ghosts, maybe step back, because that's not going to end well for you. So I think that there are bits of history that I would consider touching, and there are other bits that I would keep very well away from. Whereas British history, I'm quite happy to go around and kick some cans over, because, you know, it's fine. It's not punching down, as Freya said. I think that the early modern period of North Indian history is really interesting to me, but I've kind of been there and I feel like I've done what I wanted to do. I live with somebody who's a sort of a Reformation historian, essentially. So I've picked that up like a little sponge. And I know a little bit about that. And that's quite a fun bit of history. I think more people should play around with the Catholic the Reformation towards Protestantism. I think it'd be quite interesting.
Tilda, although Tasha, I'm going to hold on to that last comment about the Reformation for the next question. Tilda.
So I would tend to agree with everyone in that the basic, I think we should be able to write whatever we want in whatever time period we would like to set it. But I also think that we each make decisions about where we personally feel comfortable stepping into and what we don't feel comfortable stepping into. For me, currently, my stepping stone, the wall that I've made, is that if I have lived in the culture, if I speak the language, I understand the language, I can do the research in the local language, then I will allow myself to look further and really do the deep research. Because only then do I feel like I can really see it from the perspective that I want to see it from and that I want to write from. So I've noticed that with Viking history, if I did not speak Danish, if I did not speak a Scandinavian language, I would not have drawn the same conclusions, because I would not have access to the same research and the same primary materials. And so I've carried that on to other things that I've been interested in. So I've written a second story that's currently out of submission, so crossing my fingers, about 7th century Korea. And I knew I wanted to write about Korean history because I find it fascinating, but I didn't want to tackle it until I knew I could do the research in Korean and I could read the research papers and I could dive back. And I knew that my level of Korean had reached that point where I felt completely comfortable doing the research in the native tongue. And so I kind of held off on that until I felt comfortable doing it. Oh, sorry, that's my fireplace. Yeah, so for me, that's really the threshold, personally. Where I stop. If I know the culture, if I know the language, if I can immerse myself, then I will allow myself to go there. And if not, then I will hold off and let someone else talk it up.
Deep bow of respect for learning Korean, to research Korea. So I'm going to play a little off of Tasha's comment about the Reformation and say, what I want to talk about now is historical systems. So is anybody familiar with Janet Ng's Pendulum Sun? Won a bunch of awards a couple of years ago. I happen to have loved it. But one of the things I loved about it is I am myself an Anglican, and she did a masterful job of using the Anglican religion while writing an incredible fantasy novel. And her understanding of mid-19th century high church, low church Anglicanism and what it gave birth to in missionaries. If you haven't read the book, it's about Anglican missionaries to fairyland. And it's edgy and at times nasty and certainly not nice to the Anglican church, but she totally understood her system. And the rest of the 19th century is completely unimportant to the book because it's in fairyland. But that one, I'm going to call it an artifact or a system, is ruthlessly accurate, down to arguments over anti-disestablishmentarianism. So I'm just wondering, do you ever make use of a system while otherwise jumping off into the secondary world or the beloved Middle Age, fake Middle Ages of fantasy? I should have a better term than fake. The standard sort of Witcher depiction of the Middle Ages or something like that. Are there systems you prize? Are there artifacts from history that you want to use? And who would like to go first? Anyone? Great, Tilda, thank you for volunteering.
Oh, goodness, okay. well, I think so, but I haven't necessarily done it yet.
That's okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say I've probably done a form of it in terms of the Viking story, where I dwell further and further into mythology the further into the story we get. So the Vikings believed that there were 9 worlds, and obviously only one of them is the world that we know. So the further I go into the story, the further I go into the other worlds. And what I clung on to there was very much the few bits that we know of the mythology. We don't have a lot. We have pretty much 2 main texts and then a lot of depictions. And I just clung to that with all I could and then created whatever I felt like fitted in the spaces between. But I love the idea of taking something that's very real, a system or a religion or a belief, and really running with that in a completely different world, in maybe a sci-fi kind of world or a very different sort of fantasy world, because I think it can give a new perspective on the thing itself and can really make it shine in a way I don't think it can when you put it in the full context. For me, when I started writing about the Vikings, the first book is very much set in real history, and then we dwell further into mythology. And I felt like if I didn't dwell further into mythology, I wouldn't have let the gods have their moment. I wouldn't have had the mythology have its moment at all. It would just have been a part of a whole mimble, just a mix of everything. Whereas if you take it out of its context and just focus on that one thing, then it shines in a different way and it gains new life.
Tasha.
I had a bit of a think about this, and I think the thing that I pull from history wholesale often is real historical events and reshaping them, probably not a system per se, but just stories. So this particular fight for the throne in the Mughal Empire is one that I've drawn on more than once. And I loved in Game of Thrones, for example, the way it drew on the War of the Roses, because I could go, that's familiar, and the way that it was changed. And I kind of like that. It's like a little puzzle that you're trying to solve, but not necessarily systems themselves.
Jelly.
No, I'm talking without you. I'm unmuting myself. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that definitely there are, I think what you had said originally, do you like to pull these things in before you go jumping off into your world, your completely created worlds? I mean, certainly. I think, again, what I said, it helps give the aesthetic to this world. It helps sometimes ground what I want to speak of. And so I don't know if there's systems per se or artifacts, but there are certain, I think like the example you gave of, you know, getting into the nitty gritty of the Anglican Church and its operations before you go off to talk about something fantastic. Yeah, sure. Especially if I'm pulling on something from our world that helps give it that that feel of realness, that feel of quote unquote authenticity, a word I don't like using a lot, but I can't think of another word to replace it. So, yeah.
Leslie.
In some ways, yeah. Like I like to take things, you know, like talking about hoodoo in The Monsters We Defy and what I know of it just from like family and then what I've read that other people's versions of it and try to create a new version. So take what I think is accurate, like basic historical records, things like, you know, Zora Neale Hurston's ethnographic records and things like that, and then change them like 35 degrees or like take them to the left a little bit and make them my own. And so in that way, it's still a system. It's its own system, but I don't want it to be exactly that way because of what I'm doing with it. And I'm trying not to be disrespectful to people who might be practitioners or believers or, you know, have it a lot closer to their hearts. So if it's grounded in that, and then I take everything that I know and understand about it and shift it over, then it becomes my own. And I feel like I'm not disrespecting anything. And I try to do that with anytime I'm pulling like all this real information and real cultural things of cultural significance or religious significance, in order to avoid that, I just make sure that I shift it. It becomes a little bit of a puzzle because I think you can see the origins, but also you can see that it's not that thing. And hopefully that makes it unique enough.
Priya?
For me, the things that we lift out of history, I like what how Tilda put it, you pull something out of context and lift it up so that you can examine it and see it shine in its own right. Often for me, that is the basis of what a story idea might be. So the next book I'm planning on writing is about a magical medical school, and the systems that I want to pull out of history and weave into the book are things like the historical conception of the body and the historical ways in which different practitioners of different types of medicine, surgery, magical witchcraft, the ways in which the roles of those people in society were in conflict at different times in history. And so it's not a belief system per se, but there's a lot of beliefs that have been wrapped up in how we think about bodies and healing. And I want to do a bit of research that I can lift some of the interesting ones out and overlay them into the story that I'm telling about a group of people. And I think that's some of the most satisfying work that you can do when you find those gems and those systems and those ways of thinking about things. How do I shift this slightly so that it fits into the story I'm telling?
I'm going to dare to participate and say one of the things I love to talk about in fantasy is dance. Just because dance is so redolent, so cultural, and also with a nod to Tilde's experiential reenacting, because I've done some dance and it's like the kind of dance you see in Jane Austen movies, where everyone together as a community makes a pattern that you can see in so many cultures around the world. I'm just giving the example from English country dancing, but those dances exist in India, they exist in Africa, and they make patterns while the individuals are also dancing. I just love all that stuff. And I love making that either part of a magic system or part of an important social interaction scene. And I feel like it's grounding and it's a simple system. I'm not lying that this never happened in history. It's a simple system that you can imagine you can export. Anyway, my 2 cents worth. So I'm going to try and turn the whole conversation on its head and say, apparently you're all very historically minded. So can you imagine writing a book with no reference to history whatsoever? And how would that feel and where would that take you? And I'm going to start with Tasha.
It's because I pulled a face, isn't it? No.
Yep.
No, I think even if I consciously tried not to draw from history in any way, shape or form, I would still do it. And my reasoning is I think all authors do it. And you can disagree. That's perfectly fine. But I think you see it in so much speculative fiction, especially stuff looking to the future, draws very heavily from the past in order to explain how the future functions, whether consciously or not. It just underlies everything. So I don't really see how I could avoid it. And I think there's some sense in consciously drawing from history rather than unconsciously stumbling over history and bringing it to the table regardless.
Priya.
I agree. I don't think it can be done. And I was thinking about what kind of book, if someone set this to me as a challenge, what kind of book it was that I would try and write. And I was thinking, could you just do something that is very, very interior and character-based? But even then, you can't do it. No character exists as, you know, floating in a vacuum separate to the history that they grew up soaked in and the place that they grew up and the ideas that they have, even just the words that someone uses and the way they formulate their thoughts is to do with the history that they know and the place they exist. So I think you can't do any kind of story because you can't have a character, you can't have a setting, you can't have anything that makes a story without history having some kind of impact. So it feels like we're all just saying, no, sorry, paradox can't be done.
Tilda.
Well, I think it floats a bit with the idea of, is there really such a thing as a truly original story? If so, that would probably be it. But I can't personally think of something that wouldn't at least in part draw from something that I'd either experienced, seen, heard, something that is actually related to history, something that has happened to some degree for someone somewhere.
Jelly?
Yeah, I'll have to agree. I think it's a paradox. I don't know if you can create it. I think that we're all pulling from history, whether we're talking about the past, whether we're talking about the far-flung future, whether we're talking about our secondary worlds, we build on some aspect of history. So I just think it's a matter of degree and intention in how we do it. There may be some stories that are, they pull on history so absolutely, you can pretty much tell what it's pulling from. You can see and sense where it's coming from. And then, you know, some people do create, for instance, secondary worlds where they are so different and so weird and separate from ours. It may be harder to figure out what aspect of history they pulled on, and yet there are probably themes there that deal with it, right? And the way they create their social structures and the way they create their, I don't know, dynastic kingships or what have you. It's, you know, something's going to be there. So yeah, I don't think it's possible, and that story might be kind of boring.
Leslie?
Yeah, same answer. I'm writing a dystopian series right now, but, you know, even though it's in the future, you can't have, even if you're not writing human beings, like even if your entire character, all of your characters are other creatures, like as a human being, we only know what we know and we only know what we've been through. And so if you're trying to make an opposite thing that it's like no other society, you're still pulling from society to see what would be opposite. And if it's that opposite, is it even plausible or believable on a fictional level? I can't imagine it. And maybe we all have a lack of imagination, but I don't know that it's possible.
I just want to say, where were all of you when I was on this panel at Worldcon, where everyone wanted to tell me that history wasn't a big part of fantasy? And I'm like, no, you can't imagine a world without the past. Anyway, we don't have enough contention to generate that question. I think we're just all in agreement, but it is lovely to hear your points of view. Has anybody, we have run through all our questions. I have one more to toss at you, but it's pretty airy-fairy. So has anybody got anything they'd like to talk about? Tilda?
You're no, making no, that no. Face. I'm looking around. No, no. I think you got to everything.
Tasha?
No, I was muted. Sorry. Is there one period of history that you haven't written in that you're really keen to or would love to write in at some point? I'm just curious about that.
That's a great question. Would you like to answer it first?
Oh, absolutely not.
Well, that's great.
I'll throw it out there.
Let's see. I haven't called on Jelly to go first in a while, so I think it's Jelly's turn.
I don't know. I can't think of anything top of my head. So, I mean, I don't write a lot of the future. I don't. So there's something that's weird for me. I don't do a lot of. I think I have one story that's set in the future, and so I don't know if I want to. But it will be an interesting challenge on me writing something in the far flung future, and you know, like Frank Herbert. Foundational way, way, way in the future and think about how I might do that and how I would pull on the histories that we have to talk about that. And again, I don't see myself doing that anytime soon. Nobody think, oh, Jelly's going to write a futurism novel. I don't think so. But if there was something that I just don't do, that's a challenge, that would be interesting.
I thought you were going to write your medieval novel about dragons.
Yeah, there's that one. Yeah.
Leslie?
Yeah, I mean, I have that the notion to do something in the Iron Age. And I also have a vague idea of something in the 90s. Like, just go back to growing up, beginning of the internet, you know, like that kind of that era for nostalgia. We've done 80s nostalgia. It's been a big thing. So I think 90s nostalgia is next. But yeah, there's nothing, the story comes and then the story is the thing that really motivates me. And it's not really the time period. So if the story comes and it's like, oh, that has to be in, you know, 1500. Well, then I guess I'm diving into the 1500s.
Tasha, may I answer? That allowed?
Yeah, I'm not in control. So yes, but even if I were, it would be absolutely fine if you answered.
I've always wanted to write about Tang China, about 8th, 9th century China. Basically based on one story, which is that when the emperor wanted to retrain his bodyguards to make them better swords people, the greatest sword master in China was a woman. And that's all we know. Story ends right there. She came and taught them all to be better swords people. I immediately leap on that and go like, okay, surely there's a lot here. And of course, it's the sort of origin of the Silk Road. It's a fabulous cultural time. And it's a time that Europeans think of quite correctly for themselves as the Dark Ages. It's not the Dark Ages at all in China. My problem is that I know how long it took me to understand, say, 14th century Venice all by itself. So I just roll my eyes and go, I have it another lifetime. And like Tilda, I could just jump off and learn Chinese, which I'm sure I could just pick up in a, I don't know, 30-year period and start reading the literature. But I would love to, because there's so much there. Anyway, that's my two-bit answer. Freya.
I think I'm very impressionable by the research that I've already done and the stories that I've read. So having focused what research I have done on the very start of the 20th century, I've found bits and pieces on either side of the period I'm looking at that I find very interesting. And one of my favorite historical novels ever is actually set during World War One. And I think, you know, it's such trodden ground. It is one of those places that people are very interested in telling over and over, but I find it a very fascinating piece of history, especially in the ways in which the war has been mythologized. And the more reading I do about like the art movements and the writers and visual art at the very beginning of the 20th century, the more I'm interested in playing in the cultural spaces there. So I think somewhere in me is a story set in Paris in World War One, and it's probably about war artists, but I'm not quite sure what shape it has yet.
Cool. Tilda?
I think I'd probably like to explore a few different periods of Korean history. I find Korean history really fascinating, and it's something I wish more books were set in Korea during the historical period. So if I write some, more people will be drawn to it and want to write more about it. So it's a bit of a selfish wish. But this actually makes me think of something I wanted to ask you all. Because Leslie mentioned something earlier about Iron Age being more difficult to research. And I immediately thought, what? But the 20s and the 30s are way more difficult to research. There's so much more things. Like, we have more records. We have more things that we know. As someone who writes in the Iron Age, I feel like there's so much unknown that I'm pretty much free to add small details here and there. So I wonder how you all balance how much research is available, what you find difficult, if there is a lot of research or if there isn't a lot of research available.
That's an excellent question, and I'm going to allow you to re-ask it after Tasha answers her own question.
I'm very happy not to answer my own question.
Oh, come on, Tasha. What would you love to do? We won't hold you to it or tell anyone.
As long as it's a secret. I always loved the Elizabethan era when I was a kid. It was my favorite. I thought Queen Elizabeth was really cool because she had a nice outfit. Basically, that was my measure of the quality of history. So probably the Elizabethan era.
Tasha, when you were talking about great men of history and how we regard them, the person who immediately jumped into my mind was Elizabeth I. I recognize she made terrible decisions and killed an awful lot of people. And yet, looking at the level of her genius in letters, I just think, no, come on, she must have actually been great. Anyway, maybe she wasn't.
I won't go on a rant about that. I think she's been re-mythologized in a really big way in order to prop up the monarchy. But that's an aside. I think she's cool, but I also think she's been made cool. So, yeah.
Let's have a discussion sometime.
Definitely.
Right-ho. So it's now Tilda's question, and then I'm going to take questions from the audience, because that has been recommended to me by Adrian. So Tilda's question, research. No, I love your question. And because I do a lot of writing in ancient Greece, I can tell you that every single primary source in ancient Greece, you can fit on 5 or 6 bookshelves compared to, say, the American Revolution or slavery in the early 18th century or Edwardian London. I just look at that staggering amount of research and roll my eyes. Let's start with Jelly again, just because I'm being cruel. Are some eras easier to research than others? Is that a fair rephrasing, Tilda?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, do you feel like it's easier to approach an era that where there's a lot of research available, or one where there isn't and you get to fill in the holes yourself?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I think it depends. I think it can go either way. If there's a lot of research, you may feel that, especially if you're unfamiliar with it, you may feel like, oh, I've got to know everything to make sure that I don't get something wrong before I even start. Even if what you're writing about is one little corner, you feel like I have to conquer all of this information. And so sometimes it's great when there's a lot of info because there's just a lot to pull from. There's a lot to draw from. Sometimes it's great when there's not a whole lot and you're able to be a lot more inventive because people aren't certain, they're unsure. And so, you know, I've been in both situations and I don't know that one is better than the other. It's just, to me, it's just different.
Anybody else want to answer that?
Yeah, just to say that sometimes it's personality, because I feel like I'm very uncomfortable and unmoored if I don't know enough. And that's kind of why it's like, okay, if there's nothing there, yes, it gives you the opportunity to be creative. And once I get past myself, maybe I would see that. But in situations like I'm researching like a specific person from the 1830s, and it's not a lot. And so it's the freedom to do whatever I want, but I work better in boxes. I work better with boundaries. And so if the boundaries aren't external, I have to create my own, which is fine. I just am more comfortable when they're there for me. So on a personal level, it's just like the way my mind works is better if I have a lot of information that I can then be creative inside of the box, as opposed to too much freedom. Well, I'll get lost and I'll just be doing it forever.
I think I agree with that. I think I like someone to put some bounds on things and for the information to be there if I need it. And I have a fairly high tolerance for receiving emails from angry PhD students if I, you know, did actually stray into an area where there's a lot is known and I just didn't find that part in my research. That's okay. I can live with that, especially because I'm writing fantasy. But I like to know that the information is there if I go looking for it.
Anyone else? Basically, that leaves you, Tasha.
No? I'm okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go into the questions that you can see under comments. And I'm going to start with, Alan Cheeseman. What about creating history for alien species and alternate history for humanity in writing science fiction? Legendary alternate history authors include Stephen M. Sterling and Harry Turtledove. What about creating history for alien species and alternate history for humanity in writing? I would love it if somebody wanted to volunteer to take this question. Tasha.
Unless anybody else wants to, I'm happy to. Okay, well, I think that unfortunately my knowledge of science fiction is very television based, so I apologize to anybody who knows better than me. But I think that quite a lot of alien races in fiction have histories that are basically lifted and altered from real world history. It's almost all of them have been drawn from real history in some way. And I think that they can be quite interesting and rich, but they're still drawn from human history. Just like I think Leslie said earlier about the fact that, you know, we draw from human history because we're humans. When we write alien races, we draw from our human experiences, even if we combine those with knowledge we have of other races and other species when we create an alien race.
I completely agree, Tasha. I'm not sure that, going back to an earlier question, that we can go outside the human experience and actually think like aliens. But I would add to this one of my areas of dissatisfaction. It's certainly not always true, but often people who put an alien race sort of in the place of a historical context often choose the mythological historical context instead of, say, the accurate one. So it's an idea of pirates, an idea of Spartans, an idea of Vikings, and not necessarily the enormously complex nuance that maybe would make the aliens a little more exciting. Anyway, that's my critical and probably not very nice point of view. Anybody else?
I think there's also the possibility of, especially when you're dealing with non-humanoids, of commenting on history, even if you're not trying to replicate it or directly taking from a specific part of history. By diverging from it, that's also a commentary in itself. By trying to do something that's different, you also end up, in a way, in a historical place because you're commenting directly on human history.
And the idea of alternate history is taking something and changing it. You're putting this kind of a paradigm on it, but it has to be based in something. Like you pick a point in time and you diverge. It's going to be still based in something that we know and something that you could conceive of. And I think of aliens, like even if you're trying to create some brand new alien species that is, you know, a formless void or just a metaphysical, you know, spark or something like that, it's still pulling from something. So it can be very, very, very different, but I just don't see that it's possible for it not to be based, you know, not to have some research attached to it or based in something that we've researched and had history of.
I can't imagine how much historical knowledge it would take to write convincing alternate history, because you have to have an understanding of a situation to know in which direction it's going to go. I think one of my favorite alternate history sci-fis of recent years was Mary Robinette Cowell's series about the lady astronauts, and it changed history by saying, okay, we're going to have a climate crisis in the form of an asteroid in the 1950s. How is that going to change the space program and how things go from there? But it's based in this incredibly well-researched understanding of how was society functioning at the time, and you have to have that understanding to do an alternate history. I think it would take more research than I'm capable of or interested in at the moment, but when it's done in a science fiction setting to tell a really convincing alternate history, I find it very impressive.
Anyone else? One of my favorite science fiction series of all time, or science fiction books, sadly, I picked up for free in an airport and then lost the book, so I can't even tell you the author's name. It was called Cheng Kuo, and it was about a far future which was entirely dominated by Asia. And what I found fascinating was the retelling of Western history through the eyes of the West having become a sort of decadent appendage to a thriving, different culture. And I loved that. It was great. Reading about the Romans as sort of a failed experiment was very interesting. Anyway, and I wish I knew where that book had gone. I'm going to go on to, do you feel uncomfortable? The question was edited. Is there an additional responsibility if you're referencing history from other cultures than yours? So I'm actually going to daringly, as the white male, touch on this right away and say, the thing I find most complicated about this question is what culture we assume any individual is from. And that is complicated, more complicated, I think, with every change of identity and every realization of how the past has affected us. And having made that little comment, I'll let you all answer. Anybody want to take this first? Yeah. Tilda?
Can I jump on that just to go further on that? I don't think anyone would look at me and guess that I speak Korean and have lived in Korea. So most people would look at me and say, you don't know anything about that culture. You have no right whatsoever to step into it and to talk about it. But to me, Korean culture is something that I've grown up with as much as I've grown up with French culture and with Danish culture and with English culture. So if I can't write about that, I also can't write about the others. And then that leaves me nothing within the real realm of things. So I think we have to be very careful about assuming what where people are from, what they're allowed, so to speak, to write about. But there's definitely, no matter what kind of history I'm stepping into, I feel a responsibility to represent it in a way that it's not going to be rejected by the community that has grown up in it their entire life, because I haven't grown up in one culture my entire life. So I don't know exactly what that is like, but I feel a responsibility to represent it as to the truest that I can.
Anyone else? No? No takers?
I have to admit, I feel like I get asked this question a lot in lots of different iterations. Mm-hmm. And the answer is that the answer is complicated. You have to do good research in order to do a good job. And nonetheless, there is going to be a group of people who will not be happy that you are writing outside of your cultural space. They may have very valid reasons for not being happy that you're writing outside of your cultural space. But there are also people who are, you know, exist, I guess you could say, in a third culture that exists cross-culturally, like who are diaspora. Would you say, for example, that an Indo-Guyanese person couldn't write about India? You know, complicated, more complex questions there at play. So it's complicated. And I think that you have to wrestle with your own conscience and with the weight of history. And if you were not familiar with the weight of history and the barbs it leaves in certain people, probably leave that area of history alone. There's just not an easy answer. It's an essay, and it's an essay without a conclusion.
I agree. I think it's a very personal question, and the question was framed around responsibility. And as Tilda said, there's always responsibility, and the amount of it will vary depending on what you're writing and where you're coming from. And personally, I love the way that Tasha said about, are these my ghosts or not? And for me, I think personally, at the moment, that is where I'm drawing my own lines. But it's very hard to ask a question and in the hope that you'll be given an answer that contains permission, because nobody's withdrawing permission. Nobody can give you permission. It is something that everyone has to work out for themselves.
Yeah, I like Tasha's ghosts too. And I just want to say, for me, I have a Scottish last name. I know an awful lot more about medieval Venice than I know about Scotland. I know that terrible things were done to the Scots in the Highland clearances, but I don't really know very much about it. And it's not directly affecting me. So I don't think I'd choose to write about that. Although genetically, that would be closer to me than other things I could name. Anyway, it's so complicated. And to me, it's ultimately about research and respect. Anybody else want to say anything on this very fraught question before I go to our last question? Okay. I am going to try Mags the writer. Do you read fictional works from the historical period you've written in, or do you prefer to read outside of historical to get inspiration? I almost feel like that's the whole panel, but anybody want to grab this?
If the question is about, like, I read books that were written in the 20s, you know, when I'm writing in 1920s, like books that were real fiction books written then, if that's available to you, and there's plenty of time periods where there were no fiction books available. But I found that very helpful to see what, to get a feel for life, reading all across the board, like biographies, memoirs, fiction books, poetry, all kinds of things, to get an idea of what they were talking about. So if it's available and in the time period, then I think it's super helpful.
My favorite thing that I read from the Georgian era was A Giant Book of Swear Words. I can recommend that to anybody who wants to have a great time. People have always been really, really creative about swearing. I realize that's technically not fiction, but it was very fun to read.
I have read a great deal of Victorian pornography. Just going to put that out there. Look, I was reading, obviously I'm writing romance, but it was absolutely fascinating. There's some archives of it online, and just the turns of phrase that are used and the things it reveals about how people think about relationships and bodies and sex was really fascinating as a primary source. Not that I, you know, was lifting it and putting great big chunks of it in there. And I was looking at some of the ways that people were thinking about women, especially, and going, I think I can leave that where it is. But I agree that if you can find things that are written in the era, you can find some very interesting gems.
Anyone else? Well, friends, we're over our time. You guys are incredibly fascinating, and I hope that we can all sit somewhere at a table and have a beer, because I am, you may think I talked too much, but I'm dying to have spoken to almost everything every one of you said. You're all so brilliant. That was so much fun, and I hope we all get together sometime. Okay, well, thank you all for being on, and I'm sure TBRCon thanks you too. And see you next time.